In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress, and it's time for part two of the Loeb Report. Now, you may remember in part one, we covered the news that Marvel TV's new executive vice president is Jeff Loeb. We also talked about his books Ultimate X, Hulk, and New Ultimates. In this edition of the Loeb Report, we'll get into the questions that came from Word Balloon listeners all through the late winter and early spring. We'll hear more about the creation of Ultimate X with Art Adams and story points from Hulk and New Ultimates. But we'll also learn about the current status of works in progress, like Captain America White with Tim Sale and the yet unnamed Spider-Man project with J. Scott Campbell. Plus, Jeff looks back, revisiting details on Batman Hush and Ultimatum, how he originally got the job writing Cable back in 1994. You'll find out about Jeff's views of this year's slate of comic book films, which pieces of original art he owns from past collaborators, and the difficulties of writing Spider-Man's quips and the toughest story Jeff ever wrote. We also talk about the seemingly unending teen devotion to his work as a screenwriter on the films Commando and Teen Wolf. Today's episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by The Expert on Everything, a novel that's been described as Catch-22 meets 3 Days of the Condor. A young man is offered a six-figure job at Vector Systems and mistakenly is handed a prototype piece of technology that can effectively wipe out all privacy in our society. He's pursued by a governor with presidential ambitions, several U.S. senators, and begins to get death threats from the technology called Wallace, which seems to have developed artificial intelligence. BookReview.com gives The Expert on Everything 5 stars and calls it a smooth, interesting techno thriller. You can purchase the book at Amazon.com or at Edward David Gill's website, TheExpertOnEverything.com. Make sure you check this book out, The Expert on Everything from Edward David Gill. We will start with Nightwing 1982, who is, of course, Roberto from Florida, who asks, first he goes, I don't know how long you're with Marvel, but I've really been enjoying the Vertigo crime line. Do you think you might eventually write an OGN for them?
I would say not anytime soon.
And then he also asks, what artist and a writer do you think are going to have breakout years this year?
I think both Jason Aaron and Jonathan Hickman are just doing top-of-the-line stuff.
I agree.
There's a young artist that was doing the She-Hulk backups named Ryan Stegman that I think, you know, as in the next year we're going to see stuff that people are going to start noticing a lot.
Jimmy F, 1982, a different person.
Also, I think Dustin Weaver's work on S.H.I.E.L.D. is extraordinary.
That's a great book, and I'm assuming, too, that you're liking John's Fantastic Four.
Yep.
Jimmy F, 1982. Is it safe to say that the Smash one-shot that was solicited to come out from Image by you and Liefeld was an April Fool's joke, or was it something actually that was supposed to happen and never did? I was personally stoked for it. Was wondering what you do with the Hulk-like character at Image, where you could play by your own rules.
I think I really don't know. That's a Rob question.
Okay.
I didn't have anything to do with it. We had done some Smash stories back in the day of Fighting American. I'm not sure that Rob wasn't putting those together into a single book and trying to capitalize on the success of the Hulk.
Eddie Edmonds, I love the first issue of Ultimate X, and I do have to ask, was this always the intent to do this series? Was it born after Ultimatum? Can you speak to the origins of Ultimate X?
Absolutely. It was. I knew that after doing a kind of Michael Bay, Roland Emmerich theatrical epic of Ultimatum, that I wanted to do something that was quieter and more character-driven and, you know, reminded people more of things like Daredevil Yellow and Superman for All Seasons. And I knew that Arthur Adams was the artist to be able to deliver on that. I really wanted to tell stories about the aftermath of a tragedy, and, you know, so that they're going to be quieter, slower stories that will eventually get to some big rollick in action, but not for a while.
Eddie also notices a connection between Ultimate X and some of your recent TV work, like Smallville's and Heroes. Is there a connection in the way that you form the story, or am I just reading too far into it?
Probably. You know, you're probably reading too much into it, and there's probably a connection. There's not anything that I certainly don't approach stories that way. Every time I sit down, it's a brand new experience, and so, you know, however this is, I, I'm, what I'm very happy is that people are really digging the book, and that, you know, we're going to second and third printings on those books, and I have a tremendous team between Arthur and Peter Steigerwald, book, and Albert Duchesnes, who is the letterer on the book along with Richard Starkings. It's just a great group.
Very cool. Funkhorn Leghorn from Long Beach. At this point, The Punisher has been adapted to film three times, all of which left something to be desired for most of us. Conceptually, it seems like it should be a layup. I understand that we fanboys are difficult to please, but why do you suppose no one can seem to make The Punisher on film work? Interesting.
Has it been three times? I thought it was only twice.
Well, Dolph, I'm sure he's throwing Dolph in there, probably.
Gotcha. That's a good question. It's an anti-hero, you know, and you're talking about something that is kind of at the level of Death Wish.
Sure.
And, you know, those movies absolutely worked. You had the right star with Charles Bronson.
Absolutely.
But they certainly diminished as they went along.
True.
I just meant in terms of the box office. I didn't mean in terms of the films, although you could make that argument too. This is part of what we were talking about earlier, is that, you know, we haven't yet seen the smaller superhero movie work and find that audience that will go see that movie regardless of its fan base. I'm not entirely convinced yet that the female audience in particular feels comfortable going to see the superhero genre without a big star, without a big movie, without a big female cast. You can't downplay Gwyneth Paltrow's role in Iron Man. She really brought something to that movie. And I think Scarlett Johansson's going to bring a lot to the second one. I think it's important that there is a strong female lead that's running around inside of there. And I get the visceral aspect of The Punisher. I dig The Punisher in a big way. And I've always wanted to tell a Punisher story. I just haven't been able to find the time and the right artist. But who knows?
Goost. Let's see here. Thanks for doing this. I'm really enjoying these reports. I really like your honesty in answering these questions. Recently, we heard that Dan DiDio and Jim Lee are going to be co-publishers and Geoff Johns, Chief Creative Officer of DC. I'm curious what you think about these promotions. I don't mean the people, because I think they've proven themselves. What I mean is, do you think selling comics, the business part of it, should be done by businessmen or by creators who know the business and also know the creative part of the business? Is it better to have specialists do their thing or to have generalists?
I think we'll see.
Okay.
I can tell you that I wouldn't bet against Geoff Johns on anything.
Well, and I also think, too, Diane... I'm blanking on Diane's last name right now, and I don't mean to suggest any familiarity because I don't know her, but I know John Rood, I believe, that is another piece of the puzzle, has a strong business background, and that's something that I've learned from reading about him and talking to people that have had direct conversations. And I was pleased. Before C2E2, I get to attend the Retailer Summit, and I thought it was telling in a very positive way that not only were creative people represented at the summit, but also that Diane and John in particular were in the DC question and answer periods and were there listening and watching what was going on. And I thought that was really positive.
Yeah, man, he doesn't take as much of a public face as Joe does over at Marvel. But Dan Buckley is really one of the unsung heroes.
There you go.
Of that thing. I have just tremendous respect for his business acumen and for his... He's also happens to be a comic book fan and knows good story. But in terms of strategic planning, there are very few people that think in as many different models as he does in order to make things happen. In terms of, as a creative person, someone like Joe, you know, he just brings an incredible artillery, both as a writer as an artist. I just think it's a balance, and it's all about people. It's true in any business. You know, people have always wondered why actors and writers and directors don't run movie studios. And when they have, it's been a disaster. So, I don't know that it is a question of whether or not it should be business or creative people. I think what it comes down to is it depends on who they are.
Let's see. Could you tell us how you made Batman Hush? Did you start off knowing the ending and working back, or did you have another approach? As you said earlier, you started off more of as a Two-Face story. Halloween. Excuse me. Let's talk about it.
But even so, I knew where it was ending. It just was a question of that. No, you can't take on a story that's that big without knowing where you're going. You know, I've talked about this elsewhere, but, you know, whenever you set out to tell something that's going to be 12 or 15 inches long, that, for one, you have to have a really good relationship with your artist, and I had an extraordinary partnership with Jim. But secondly, you kind of lay it out the same kind of way that if you were going to travel from New York to L.A., you know you want to be in L.A. at issue 12, and you know that along the way you want to get to Chicago and you want to get to Dallas, but you just didn't know that you were going to have a flat tire and you're going to be stuck in Nashville at some point. And that's what happens along the way, is that, you know that by issue 6 you want to get to the Joker, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to do an interesting Nightwing story at issue 9 that you hadn't thought of at the time. Part of the fun of doing that book was that, you know, it's an opportunity for Jim and I to really explore the Batman universe, both with Batman and without him.
I was interested to learn at your signing at C2E2 that one of the pages that you own from Hush is, you know, one of the big emotional moments of the story.
Yeah, it was one of those classic things where Jim had come to me and said, you know, you pick a page. So incredibly generous of him, given how much those pages go for.
You bet.
And I think, you know, he would have expected me to do one of the big splashy Joker pages or something like that. And I just wanted to kiss Rick, Catwoman, and Batman kiss each other on top of the boat, on top of the train, against the moonlight. It's a big scene.
Yeah, and I remember a couple of years ago at a convention, Jim selling like a limited edition like prints of that, just huge, just that panel of them. And I don't know if he recreated it himself. I don't know how he did it. But get going for crazy amounts of money, and I saw people picking it up because it really made this amazing print. And it is that really cool moment of Batman and Catwoman revealing each other, you know, to themselves and having a real moment together. That's pretty neat, man.
It's one of the funs of doing it was that, you know, being able to finally push that relationship in that direction. Particularly since I'd spent so much time playing around with it with Tim Sale on Halloween and Dark Victory, where they were just teasing each other, to finally sort of be able to culminate it in a way that hadn't been done before.
And it's funny because I don't know where current continuity is with not only that relationship, but also even the reveal at the end of Hush with, and I don't want to spoil for people who maybe hadn't read it, but I think you see some of these villains and specifically Batman and Catwoman now, and if it's been wiped away, it always seems to me that the subtext of their revealing to each other remains, the hurt that followed still remains, and even again, the one villain I think that is the big reveal at the end of Hush, I think even though things have changed, I still sense it when I see these characters play with each other, that it's something that the villain still has over the hero.
Yeah, I would hope so. I think a lot of that stuff got washed away. And I'm not sure it got washed away for the right reason.
Yeah.
There were certainly people that felt that my contributions for leaving should then be erased. And I don't know that that's the best thing to do. But that was then, not now.
Sure.
I don't know what's going on now.
Mimic from Akron, Ohio. Jeff, love your color books, your current Hulk run, and especially your work at DC. I was wondering if you had ever been approached to write or produce the next Superman feature. Or a
haven't,
Superman.
Would love to. Kill to, jump over dead bodies to. never happen. Maybe someday, never know.
Ultimate Dead Cap. Hey, Jeff, do you think certain characters, like established B and C-list characters, not so much new characters, benefit from being in books that are not titled after the main character of the book? Like when DC relaunched Adventure Comics with Superboy. I feel like doing so can give the impression that the publisher believes the character is strong enough to carry a book without having to appeal to a narrow demographic, like younger readers looking for something juvenile like Boy in the title, or that the book is about a larger and deeper idea or theme than a particular character fits and hence is in the book for that reason. Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think that if we could figure out how to sell it by putting pictures of goats on the cover, we'd put pictures of goats on the cover. I don't know that anyone is more inclined to buy an adventure comic than they would be to buy Superboy. The right team, the right artist, and the right promotion is all you can really do and hope that it works. You can point to it time and time again. Green Lantern shouldn't work. It works great. Our Supergirl launch was bigger than anything anybody ever expected. The Red Hulk. Every time there's something that pops, people just look at it and scratch their heads and try to figure it out. Deadpool's success, you can't guess any of that stuff, and I don't know that it would have made a difference what the book's called. It just happens to be the right team at the right time. People want it.
Zach Goyette from Grand
Rapids. Zach.
Here we go. Let's see. Do you have any updates on Captain America White or your Spider-Man project with J. Scott Campbell? It's been a while since we've heard anything about them.
Yeah, unless you go to convention and then everybody asks me. I can tell you that both are still in the works, and there are beautiful pages from each. I can tell you that given the marketplace's reluctance to invest in something that doesn't come out on a regular basis, both artists felt like they wanted to be able to take the time to get enough of it done. I know that in particular Tim's case, we really felt like, let's just get it all ready. And our target is to try to get it out for the movie. That's what I can tell you.
Okay. Is Tim's current status at DC, is he a free agent again, or is he...
Tim has been at Marvel for a year.
Okay. Shame on me.
Yeah, he finished up what he needed to do on the Kryptonite story, and then that was the end of his obligation.
I see. Okay. Let's see. Oh, and then also he wants to know... because there's a couple questions that I feel like we get a lot of sometimes, and I get a little crazy about them. But I will throw them out there, and if you have answers, that's fine. You've worked with some great artists throughout your career. Who's left on the list of artists that you still want to work with that you haven't yet?
It's gotten down to such a few group of people that I now I'm keeping them secrets.
Okay.
Because there's so few. I can tell you that the people that are on Hulk 23 are some of my heroes, so that's just been great.
That's cool. And then this one I think would also be in the nature of spoiling. Are there any Marvel characters that you want to write that you haven't yet? I hate that question, but I'm asking it anyway.
No. I always appreciate that. There's a couple of things that are going to get announced in the next, I'd say, by San Diego that I think will surprise people in terms of what I'm going to do next and who I'm going to do them with.
Okay. How did you go about choosing who will live and who will die during Ultimatum? We got into that a little bit in terms of what's making the universe different.
A lot of it had to do with what the aftermath was going to be. We knew where we wanted to be. Obviously, it was very mutant-centric because that was going to drive what was happening with Ultimate X. A lot of it had to do with whether or not those characters were completely copies of what was going on in the multiple universe. And then a lot of it had to do with what Mark and Brian really wanted to do and where they were headed. So it was certainly, I didn't just take a checklist and just knock things off. There were lots and lots and lots of conversations, and people who were on the list and then were not on the list and then were on the list again. But everybody that we talked about in the end got what was coming to them.
Lie from Florida. Yo, Loeb.
Yo.
Do you have any plans to be part of the Heroic Age? And will you be a part of the Hulk family after the fall of Hulk's World War Hulk's thing is going down?
There's big stuff that's being worked on right now, and to a lot of those questions, the answer is yes.
Okay. Mac Venom. What is it about the Hulk that draws you into the character?
We talked a little bit about it, you know, the kind of the wish fulfillment of
the id.
You know, the id, and, you know, and what you would do. I personally just like the tragedy of the story, you know, that Bruce Banner was this guy who, you know, wanted everything to be a certain way and couldn't, and the world just wouldn't let him do it. And then he became this a beast that would enable him to do it, but that it came at the cost of losing everything that he had. And I think we're starting to see more and more internally of what's going on with the Red Hulk and what he had set out to do and what he had hoped to do. But it certainly was, from the very beginning, a very specific story that I wanted to tell. And it will come to a conclusion at the end of the war.
Fonkhorn Leghorn is back to ask, Marvel Man in the 616, yay or nay, and would you ever be interested in writing the character?
Not something that I will discuss in terms, because I don't know any of the plans, which should tell you that I'm not involved with any of those plans either.
Fair enough.
Looking forward to it, though.
Okay. Luke C., I'm certainly looking forward to Neil Gaiman finishing his story, and Bucky. And I mean Mark Buckingham, not, of course, Bucky Barnes. Because that, you know, two different Buckys. Anyway, Luke C. from Sydney. Hi, Jeff. Which comic book movie adaptation are you most looking forward to seeing this year?
Is there more coming out this year?
Well, Brian O'Malley's Scott Pilgrim film, Jonah Hex. Is that it? Or is it just those three? Beyond Iron Man 2?
I would say out of that group, it would be Iron Man 2.
I would understand. Okay.
But I'm really super curious about Thor. The stuff that I've seen on the net and the interviews and things like that just make it sound like it's going to be the coolest thing ever.
Cool. Great casting, too. Really interesting casting in a lot of ways. Sincere from New Zealand. From the other side of the world. Here we go. Hi, Jeff and John. This is my first post on the Bendis Boards. I've been drawn here due to John's superb work producing Wilberman. Thank you, sir. Devouring his episodes. I was drawn into comics at the age of 14 back in 1994 due to the X-Men animated cartoon. My local comic book store was always a place that seemed a bit taboo, but I was pulled in, and the first book I picked up was Jeff and Steve Scroche's Cable 19.
Yeah.
Last chapter of the Dark Ride storyline. The cover is my avatar. There it is. I had no idea who Cable was before I picked up this book, and through Steve's visuals and your writing, I was instantly drawn to the character and have picked up everything Cable has appeared in since, even the god-awful Soldier X series. Cut to the chase. How did you land the Cable gig?
By sheer accident. I had written Batman, the Long Halloween, the first Halloween special, mm-hmm. called Fears, and I got a call from, I remember exactly where I was, And the woman on the phone says her name is Lisa Patrick, and she worked for Bob Harris, who was then the editor-in-chief and grand poobah at Marvel Comics, and was head of the X-Men group. And she said, I have that they had read the Batman story and really liked it, and she had three questions for me. One was, I a fan of the X-Men? I think it was actually four questions. Was I a fan of the X-Men? I said, yes. And she said, would I be interested in writing the X-Men? I said, who is this? and she just said, I need you to tell me. And I said, yeah, are you kidding me? That's, you know, particularly at the time, it was the Golden Crown. She said, do you have the time to do it right now? I said, yeah, I'm available. I can do that. And she said, do you know what it's like to work in the X-Men office? And I said, no. And she said, perfect. and I didn't realize what that last part meant until I actually started working in the X-Men office, which is a very, very challenging, challenging place. And they called and said that, so sort of give everything a perspective, Cable was selling 130,000 copies.
Wow.
At the time.
And that's poor, probably, back then.
And it was a disaster. I was told that the book was losing 5,000 readers a month, and that if it got below 100,000, they were going to cancel the book.
Wow.
And so I had literally five issues to stop the bleeding. And Steve was already on the book, so I inherited the art team. And I got lucky. It was 6 months before the Age of Apocalypse. And the issue 20 was supposed to be the story when we went into it. And the way that Scott Lobdell had structured the Age of Apocalypse, Bob realized that there was no goodbye issue. There was no issue where the X-Men could say goodbye to each other. And I had not turned in a plot yet, and he turned to me and said, would you mind if that's where we did it? And I got a young artist by the name of Ian Churchill, who had only done an annual up to that point for them. And we did An Hour of Last Things, which was really the sort of the first X-Men-y X-Men story that I did.
Cool.
On the basis of that, I was... You know, I got Cable, I got X-Force, and I got X-Man. It really, that was a big turning point issue for me.
Were there any storylines and plans that you had planned for Cable that were never followed up on? I recall near the end of the Onslaught tie-ins and the Microverse arc in the mid-30s that G.W. Bridge and S.H.I.E.L.D. were on Cable's trail. Where was this heading?
Oh, it was a huge story, not the least of which was that the technovirus that was in his system was going to take him over, and he was going to not be able to function, and that he would slowly only be able to speak in Ascani. And he formed a friendship with Storm, and at one point we pitched a romance with Storm. And Bob, again, it was a very challenging time. Bob Harris, who was the editor, it was as though he woke up out of a coma at one point and looked at what was going on in the book and wanted to know what the hell we were doing. And when we explained it, he said, stop all of it. And if you read those issues, the technovirus is eating Cable alive, and his body is completely going against him. And we were having an awful lot of fun, and the visuals were extraordinary. And then suddenly the next issue, he didn't have any more. and that was the kind of thing that happened in that office. It just would never happen again. Not at Marvel.
What do you think of Cable's current direction, and would you like to write the character again? My money is on Marvel to kill him off during this summer's Second Coming X crossover.
I like what they're doing, and there's been times when I've thought about revisiting not just Cable, but X-Force as well.
Very cool. That is the most I've ever spoken about Cable on Wordbull. And that's okay, because I'm happy to do it, because I know that's a... No, honestly, man, I know that that's...
I know, you're a big X-Men fan. You follow all that stuff. You're such a jerk.
I'm in the minority. I freely admit that. Freely, man. Absolutely, man. And no, honestly.
Look, I'm delighted you've been reading my books just for this interview. That's always a nice thing.
And it's not out of anything but joy of the books. I am enjoying New Ultimates. I'm enjoying Ultimate X.
I've made a believer out of you.
Truly.
Because I realize that unless Bendis' name is on it, I'm actually reading those books.
I got faced by Bendis. I'm not reading Ultimate Enemy or Ultimate Mystery, whatever it is, the mini.
It's actually really good, and Rafa,
who's
drawing, is just grown in ways. It's extraordinary.
Absolutely. I do agree with that. So, you know, I only have so many comic book dollars each
month. You seem to find the time to read things like Jonah Hex. You can find time.
I love Jonah Hex.
I know you do.
Truly. Oh, man. All right. John C. from Ireland. Oh, wait. I blew off. First of all, Sincere says, thanks in advance for answering the questions. He looks forward to reading more of your work and hearing more from me. So that's very nice, Mark. We appreciate it. Mark from New Zealand there. Sincere. Dave, 0923. Hey, guys. To start off, I'd like to thank you both for doing another edition of The Lore Report. As always, I'm a big fan of both of you. It's been a very big 2010 for me so far. I'm publishing my first comic book. Oh, look, it's a commercial for him. I'm teasing you, Dave. Both in print and online this April. And I've been accepted into a college that will allow me to dedicate my passion for writing. I plan on majoring in both screenwriting and film. Jeff, you've been one of my biggest heroes and role models for as long as I can remember. And you've had the career I'd really like to aspire for myself. Writing for TV and films, and most importantly, comics. So do you have any advice for a kid leaving a small New England town? Sounds like the beginning of a Penthouse Forum letter. And planning on taking on the world? A pretty big and vague question, but any advice would mean the world to me.
This is going to sound ridiculous. It's two things. One, if you're going to write, write every day. Writing is as much about the discipline of writing as it is about actually what you write. It is getting up every day. It's going to sound very silly, but my screenwriting teacher in film school said to me once, get a book and, a blank composition book, mm-hmm. and write a page a day. And guess what? At the end of the year, you'll have 365 pages. They may not be very good, but they will be better than they were when you started. And you can't cheat. You can't write 5 pages and then say, okay, now I don't have to write for the next 5 days. If you happen to write 5 pages, then that's great for you, but then you need to be able to write a page the next day.
Okay.
And the second thing is that do not let anyone take your dreams away from you. The way that you... I've been using this one lately, is that when you're having a really great dream, the last thing you want is for someone to wake you up. So why would you do that in life? Why would you let anybody, whether it is your parents or whether it is your teacher or whether it is a girlfriend or whether it is your boyfriend, ever say to you, you can't do that. You're not good enough to do that. You would never let that happen. So the thing to do is don't let anybody chase you away from your dreams. Just stay at it.
He also wants you to know, his collaborators and I just want you to know, we all love Hulk. When we get our hands on a new hardcover, the three of us read it and then talk about who we think the Red Hulk is. It's a huge experience for us. We all love your work and can't wait to see more. Love the show, guys. Keep it up. Very nice. Thank you, Dave. John C. from Ireland. He's a regular. I'm not going to do the accent, don't worry. He hopes that you're having a good 2010 so far. I really enjoyed the first issue of Ultimate X and looking forward to New Ultimates. Okay, this was written, by the way, in February, in fairness. I was wondering, has there been any difficulty in getting the okay to kill off Wolverine and introduce his son, who is not Dakin, as you say, or Dakin? I say Dakin. You say Dakin?
Let's call the whole thing off.
Exactly. Who was the first person in the room who said, I think we ought to kill off Wolverine?
I think it was Axel Alonso.
Okay.
It certainly, when we started talking about how to make this thing different, we just said, well, what would a world be like without Wolverine in it, given how many things Wolverine's in?
Sure.
So it was important. And I think people will see that Jimmy, isn't Wolverine. And he's not Dakin or Dakin or whatever his name is.
Hulk is awesome and loving the fact that Betty and Glenn Talbot are back. Me too. I still reckon you have a list somewhere of who you want Red Hulk to beat up next. Is there any chance of seeing Hulk go up against Galactus? since he's already knocked out the Watcher?
He did. First of all, we don't call him Rolk. I think that's important. That's something that, you know, internet fanboys everywhere decided to do. I think it's kind of a disparaging way.
All right, better Rolk than Chlor. Come on, now.
Yeah.
But go on.
For sure. Red did try to go up against Galactus, and it was in the Offenders Defender story.
Okay.
And it was really a disastrous attack. I did like, however, that the Green Hulk referred to him as Hockey Stickhead. That's what I liked.
True. Let's see. And then we already discussed if you have any input into Marvel Studios. I guess we haven't really, because I asked you more about Disney and any possibilities of future projects. Have you gone in the room yet and talked about some of the films in production?
Those guys do great jobs. I'm in awe of what Kevin does, that's all good.
All right. And as always, I get STA or Sta Redcraft or Stirtcraft. His name wrong, so it's one of those three different ways. But let's see. Hey, Jeff, I'm always loving your work, and one of the few people in my circle of friends who still reads Hulk. Their loss. Well,
okay.
There you go. You got you got Pete and his friends all loving the Hulk, and now you got Stare Redcraft being the lone person in his circle that loves Red Hulk.
Okay.
But there you go. I have a few questions and one comment suggestion. I've heard rumors that the whole Who is the Red Hulk after issue one suffered from a Captain Atom Monarch fiasco, where people apparently found out he was already, and the identity had changed. Okay.
No.
There you go.
It's always been what it's been. We have absolutely done things in order to get people to think it's something other than what it is.
You're right.
And how we did that, I can't tell you.
Fair enough. You're right.
We poisoned the reservoir.
You write a fantastic Jen Walters She-Hulk. If offered to write her on an ongoing basis, would you accept? And what artist would you want to join you in the title?
Stay tuned.
I know the idea of Red Hulk was given to you, you when you got the job of writing Hulk, but where did She-Hulk, or She-Red Hulk, Samson, and A-Bomb come from? I'm especially interested in how you came up with Rick becoming A-Bomb. Yeah, Rick as A-Bomb has been a lot of fun. And again, good moments from the funeral with Rick as A-Bomb.
That has as much to do with my partnership with Ed McGuinness. There are points where I don't remember what, who came up with what when, but it certainly had as much to do with that as anything else.
Okay. Here is my comment. There's this web personality known as the Nostalgia Critic, a guy who reviews nostalgia movies. Listen to what qualifies as nostalgia movies. Usually things prior to 2000 or so.
Ooh.
Jesus. In January, he reviewed Commando.
Mm-hmm.
I really recommend if you haven't already for you to check it out. This is really a funny review.
Cool.
So, in fact, you know, Brandon, my friend who was doing video for me at C2E2 that you met last weekend, I was informing him. And, yes, he was impressed that you were writing the Hulk, but his eyes got really impressed when I mentioned Teen Wolf and Commando. And he's like, really? Yes.
There's a generation that grew up with those movies that, you know, they are their godfathers. It frightens me that I can say that. I'm very grateful for everyone who loves those films, and I'm very much would like to show them other movies as well.
I understand. But always very cool. So, in fact, here, how's this? This weekend was the Pulp Show, the Chicago Pulp Show, which is so much more of a real collector show versus... I love what comic book conventions have become. Don't get me wrong. I like all the pomp and circumstance. But every now and then it is nice to go to a real collector's show. And what I love about the Chicago Pulp Show is literally guys like Steranko and Jerry Conway fly in still to go to it.
Seriously?
As collectors.
Cool.
Yeah, and as collectors. Jerry was here this weekend. Steranko was not. But the Wachowskis still show up for it as well, which is interesting in its own way. But it's really cool. Jeff Darrow and the Giannis and stuff. And what I'm getting to is I got a Merv Griffin interview DVD. Yeah, I know. And it has an interview with him and Arnold from like right after the first Conan movie came out.
Just too great.
And I love that. I just love seeing that Arnold back in the 80s. You know, not too far from Commando.
That was my guy.
There you go. So, anyway, personal observation. Thank you for indulging, as always. Michael Dark. Is it safe to assume that Jen's story is pretty far from done and that we haven't seen the last of her?
Yes.
More of a comment than a question. Even if people know who the Red Hulk is, don't let that lead you to pull a last-minute switcheroo. The real fun is the ride, regardless of if you know the destination or not. So is...
It's done and strong. It's inked its letters. We couldn't stop it now, even if it was on the front page of the Herald Tribune.
Is Bruce or is Red Hulk Lyra's dad? You can do a stay tuned.
It's been established. It's Lyra. Bruce is Lyra's dad.
Okay. And Thundra will be back, right?
A lot of that story's been told by the time that question has been.
Okay.
That's already come out stuff. So.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, this is late. This again was late Feb. So forgive me. All right. PJ Conrad. Jeff, thanks again for taking time to do another report. As a creator, how do you organize your thoughts and ideas? Do you have one journal in which you put everything in, or do you have different journals or perhaps folders on a computer pertaining to your different projects? Is there a system you recommend? Basically, he wants you to clean his computer, clearly, and his room.
You'll be very disappointed. I work with a yellow legal pad, and I, down the left side of the margin, do 1 through 22. And across the top, write the title of the issue that I'm doing, and then I fill in the blanks. And sometimes I write the last five pages first, or the first five, or a middle scene, or things like that. And if I have to do more than one thing, then I just work on different pages of the same yellow pad. And then I fill up the pad, and when it's done, I stick it in the closet.
I wish you continued success on Hulk Ultimate X and your future projects, says PJ.
Thanks.
Let's see. Mr. Dave. Hey, Jeff, I really enjoyed Ultimatum. Fun story that got me interested enough to pick up the tie-ins. Your writing worked great with Finch's art. Also loved Wolverine Evolution. So when do you plan on doing more work in the X-Men universe? I love Wolverine and hoping you want to revisit your X-Force days. We were just talking about that. Lots of big-budget action you can tell with those guys.
It was always planned, and I don't know when our schedules are going to be able to do it, but there was always a plan to do... the sequel to I don't think of a sequel. I actually think it's the rest of the story to Evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you that have been out there, you know, burning me in effigy, Sabretooth story is not over. But it really has come down to they have offered me a couple of other artists to finish the story with, and I've always promised that Simone was going to finish it. We will tell the true origin of Romulus. What went on there, and it's the other. For me, it's the other half of the story. The problem was that we could only do a finite amount. I told as much of the story as I could. I hoped that I could get back to it sooner than I could, but Simone's schedule. He went on to do Astonishing X-Men with Warren,
mm-hmm.
And so it became difficult for both of us to be able to do it. But that story will get told.
Also, when is Marvel going to produce the X-Force Visionaries Jeff Loeb collections? That's nice.
I have no control over anything that would have anything named Visionary after my name.
From Sydney, it is Leaf Insect Man.
Ah.
A longtime favorite here on the
show. We have a lot of Australian guys today.
We really do well in the Pan-Asian quarter. We definitely do. Hiya, Jeff and John. Thanks for doing another one of these. Hope you guys are having a fun time. Do you have a lot of original art from your collaborators, and which ones are your favorites?
I don't have a lot of original art. I do have, although my collaborators, I'm sure, would say otherwise. Obviously, the thing that I have most of is I probably have the finest collection of Tim Sale artwork in the land. you know, we talked earlier about the Jim Lee piece that I have.
Right.
I think, you know, they're...
You got pages of that stuff, I'm sure?
Yes. The things that are my favorite, I have all of Sam's story, which is the Tim Sale story that mm-hmm. he did about my son that's in Superman Batman 26.
Mm-hmm.
I have... the story that Sam wrote with Tim Sale for Tales of the Vampire, number five.
Cool.
That he did with Timmy. There's a little two-page when Clark met Bruce that Tim did when they were kids. It's a baseball story that got evolved. It was like in the back of a Superman secret file.
I remember that, yeah.
And it actually now gets collected with the For All Season stuff. So that stuff's important to me. But then I have three pieces, including a cover that Mike Turner did from
Girl from Krypton.
From Girl from Krypton. And he signed the cover with with a note, which is, you know, we said we were going to do it, and we did it. And that pretty much summed up how much fun we were having doing it.
So, that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, all the artwork that I have all, you know, lends itself back to memories of working with the people. That's why I don't really own any other original artwork. I have one Neil Adams piece from Avengers 93 that was the first thing I ever bought.
That's cool.
But other than that, everything I have has been a gift.
Wow. You know, if I had the cash, a piece of Ed's that I would get is from the Defenders storyline, and that is that sad sight of the Hulk cradling Jarella's dead body after he's been had.
I'm not sure where that piece is. It originally was the cover.
I remember you telling me that, absolutely.
And has a different background. Then the page, we had to change the background in order to make it work in the story. I literally had to work the story around to get to that place, which is why there's a 9-panel grid before it happens, because we were running out of pages.
I see. Wow. Well, Ozman from Miami. You'd think Ozman would be from Australia, but he's not. Mr. Loeb, thank you for your years of service to great storytelling. Here are my questions. Reading through your stories in Ultimate Comics and reading Bennis Millar and reading Bennis and Miller's, I feel there's a different approach to how you both see certain characters such as Hawkeye, Thor, and especially Tony Stark. How do you go about coming up with motivations and objectives for these characters for your stories? Do you discuss these choices with other creators in the Ultimate line, or do you just make those choices based on what you feel and go without other portrayals that are taking place in other books coming out simultaneously?
You're going to be disappointed in me. I'm actually trying to do the best I can. I think people read things different ways. I know a lot of people were surprised that Thor in Ultimate 3 spoke with these and thous and those, and Mark didn't have him talk that way. That was not my doing. I inherited that off of J. Michael Straczynski, who just decided to change it in Ultimate Power. And once that happened, I didn't know how to undo it without undoing what Jay, with what Joe had done. Hawkeye was a character that Mark and I spent a lot of time talking about, and making him the way that he was something that grew out of that relationship. And I would be curious, after you've read New Ultimates, whether or not I steered Tony back more towards what you had in mind. Tony has a very specific voice that I think Mark does extremely well. But other people do other ways. I think if you read The Ultimate Armor Wars that Warren did, I think that voice is very different from what Mark does. So it's a challenge. Absolutely.
Okay, and then he asks, are you planning on doing some DC work in the near future? It would be interesting to see your take on Green Arrow, or maybe even Legion of Superheroes.
Jim and I were going to do Legion of Superheroes. He actually did a whole bunch of drawings that we talked about doing after Hush that never happened. And I have a whole take on a Green Arrow movie that I once almost set up that I suppose I could take and use to do a Green Arrow comic book. I will do a shout out to my buddy JT Krull, who is taking over Green Arrow. And mm-hmm. from what I am told by people who know these sorts of things, that first issue is as good as comic gets.
So cool.
Get out there.
I've enjoyed what he's been doing with Green Arrow and Arsenal, and really loved his Blackest Night Teen Titans crossover.
That's how he got the gig. So, and a super, super nice guy.
Yes, he is. I've had the pleasure. Very good guy. Michael Deary. Hi, guys. On the Spider-Man 2 DVD extras, you said that writing Spidey was more difficult than some other characters. In what way is he more difficult?
The immediate thing, I don't know what I meant then, but the immediate thing is that it's the quips. Comedy's hard, and particularly when you're doing a character that's been around for as long as Spidey has, it's hard to come up with a new twist and a line that he's going to say. Johnny and I have talked about this. Bad drama is bad drama. Bad comedy isn't anything.
Yeah.
And so if you write a line and it just lies there like a piece of lead, then the whole scene can die. And unfortunately, you don't have the same ability that you have with almost every other character where if you're in the middle of a fight scene or something like that and you just decide, you know what, I don't want to write any dialogue here. Spidey doesn't do that. He talks all the time. So you're stuck in that place of trying to come up with really good dialogue, so it's challenging.
What's the most difficult thing you ever wrote, and how did it make you a better writer?
I don't know the answer to that, other than we were just talking about it. I can't imagine that there was anything more difficult than writing the Sam story after my son's death. And I remember, the suggestion to do it came from Paul Levitz, who had told me a story, which I am always reluctant to tell because it's about someone else's pain. But then I read it in a book, so that he made it public. Will Eisner had a daughter who died of leukemia, and out of that, Paul tells me, is where a contract with God had come from. And when you read a contract with God, you'll understand it.
Right.
And, Contract with God was a seminal work and is widely regarded as the first. I love that you guys call it an OGN now. Every time I hear that, I'm like, what does that mean? Original graphic novel. And he suggested that maybe I try to put my feelings down on a piece of paper, and I couldn't think of anything that would be a greater waste of time than trying to touch what Sam had touched in my life. And as, they say in these stories, I sat down, I wrote it all at once, and I gave it to Tim, and he cried and drew it, and gave it to Richard Starkings, who lettered it and cried when he lettered it. And it's as good as anything I'm going to do, and in many ways I kind of wish that was the last thing I had done. But then I would have stopped doing the thing that I love and the thing that Sam loved me doing, so it's not a perfect end of a story, but it's as good as it gets.
I'm curious, Jeff. I want to ask about Fallen Son, and also this is maybe a good opportunity to ask about General Ross's funeral that just happened in Hulk. Mm-hmm. Is the experience of Sam's death and funeral still? I know it was for the case of Fallen Son, and I know that there are very specific things we've discussed before in other Loeb reports where you've said, this came from a real moment in Sam's funeral. But I was wondering for Thunderbolt Ross, who in this case is, a father figure and also a very complicated man. And I thought a lot of interesting stripes of his character came through in his funeral. And does that come from a very different place?
I'm comfortable writing those scenes because I've now, had the unfortunate experience of having done a few of them. I did my dad's as well.
Okay.
But you know, what I like about telling those stories is that there's no subtext. You can just have a character get up there and just talk about how they feel about somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, part of what I, you know, what I liked about the funeral wasn't that it wasn't just all just, you know, first of all, Ross is a very complex guy and a guy that he was essentially a villain. So, that,
yes.
You know, to have this sort of celebration of his life, I knew that the one person that was going to be able to talk about him in a way that you would care about it was Banner. And that really what made him a good person was his love of his daughter. And so as long as we could get to that place, you know, I think that what made the issue fun for me was that when Ben, the Thing, you know, talked about him like he was a nut job. And to him, he was a nut job. And I liked it. That the other moment, which was because, and again, if you've ever gone to a wedding or a funeral, you have these kinds of conversations. When Steve says, Rogers says to Rick, you know, the man gave his whole life in service of his country, and I think that's worth celebrating, or whatever he said. And,
right.
And then Rick's response was really, because I thought he was a jerk. I think the way people talk about someone when they're getting married or a seminal moment in their lives. I
mean, certainly.
It's all the same. I mean, that same issue could have just as easily been a roast as well.
Sure. And it reveals as much about the character saying it as it does about the character that they are honoring.
And that's the fun. And those issues, to me, are difficult to write, but they're also fun to write because you get the opportunity to be able to, like, to do little moments. And
mm-hmm.
So those are the kinds of things that often take me much longer because I'll, you know, when we're talking about the yellow scratch pad, that, you know, that legal pad gets very filled up with stuff. And sometimes you write a scene or a moment or a piece of dialogue between two characters and you realize, okay, I don't have enough room to do this. And that's a bit I'll have to save for another day.
I'm going to jump to the Freaky Tiki, who you met in Boston and was working at Abe and Louie's restaurant, which is a restaurant that you were at in Boston.
Okay, yeah. I was there with, I think, my mom having lunch.
Well, and he asked also, he said there was another gentleman who was with you, and he said, how in shock was the other gentleman when you acknowledged Jeff for your comic work? The guy was in complete shock that anyone who seemed to be in complete shock that anyone would even know who you were, which I think is hilarious.
Okay, and this will tell you volumes about my life. The gentleman that he's talking about is my stepfather.
Okay.
So he literally had never had that experience of my being recognized anywhere. It's a little more different in Los Angeles, but more importantly, he's never been to a comic book convention,
sure, either.
So he doesn't know that there's legions of people, like all 12 of them that know who I am.
Well, Kelly, I like what Kelly Sue DeConnick says, and she says there's famous and then there's comic book famous, which is true in terms of, like, in a convention, you're a household name. But then on the street, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, look, I'm not trying to make this sound anything other than what it sounds like, and that is I am extraordinarily lucky, and I say this all the time. Anyone who's ever gotten a comic book signed by me will have heard me say, I cannot do what I do unless they do what they do. It is a partnership. I am so grateful that people buy the books. And continue to. It's amazing to me that I get to do this thing that I love so much, and people let me do it.
There are two people left, and then we're done.
Okay.
Because I know we've been going, we're almost at 3 hours, but I just wanted to let you know that we're about to clean the cake, which is very good.
Okay.
All right. First of all, we've got Nick Maynard. Now, he asks two questions. It's one that you've covered before. But let's see if we can ask it individually. What is your favorite Stan Lee comic, and what about Jack Kirby? So I know that you've discussed before how much you love that run of Fantastic Four, for example.
Yeah.
but is there a way to separate and say, okay, what about a non-Jack Stan story and a non-Stan Jack story?
Well, people know I'm a huge New Gods fan. And so, you know, all that stuff, you know, Commandy is great stuff.
Yeah.
So that kind of standalone Jack, I love. But yeah, you're not, I mean, for me, you right around FF 36, 37, you know, a blind man can lead them where, you know, Daredevil is the hero of the story. And you go all the way up to, you know, the mid 80s where they went into Subatomica, as they used to refer to the Microverse. And, you know, it's just, it's extraordinary. There's nothing like it in comics. The number of characters that are introduced, the visuals, the number of balls that both guys were throwing in the air as they were drawing and writing 5-6 other books, and meanwhile over the Fantastic Four that they were creating, from everything from the Silver Surfer to the Inhumans to Galactus to Black Panther, the Doc Doom Silver Surfer storyline. You know, Doom himself has never been portrayed as well as in those stories. I could read those things over and over. This Man, This Monster is probably the single best one issue done, period, ever. FF51. It's sort of mind-boggling that anybody could come up with as much stuff as they came up with in about a 2 or 3 year period. It's as beautiful as it is. Really.
Excellent. And then he also asks, who is your favorite 70s Marvel comic book writer and favorite artist? Just from the 70s.
You know, I probably have to throw it to Roy.
Okay. Sure.
Just at Marvel.
Sure.
Just because he was just doing so much of this stuff. And you know, by the same token, you know, it would be over with John Buscema. You know,
that's cool.
They really were sort of the next step. You know, they were the ones that sort of gave Marvel. Roy dug deeper, was less jokey, and took more chances in terms of the characters, particularly on the Avengers. And then, you know, John, it wasn't a house style. It was just a style that was, the women were more beautiful than Jack was drawing, and the men were more anatomically interesting. John's work just was less monster based and more pretty based. And I think really changed the way the comics were being drawn and thought about at the time. And then, you know, I don't know if I've got my decades properly or anything. You know, once you throw Neil Adams in there, then the whole game changes. And, you know, what Neil was doing is just so extraordinary. And so those are my guys. Steranko, but I think at that point, I'm not sure Steranko was in the 70s. I could be wrong.
Okay. All right. Well, I think you're right at that point, too. It was probably more of the cover work than it was any interior work.
Right.
Our final question comes from the Michael.
The final question.
Indeed.
Of
this Loeb Report. Jeff kind of embarrassed us, Sam, 35 years old, and just...
And I don't know who you are.
And just saw Teen Wolf for the first time.
Ah.
With the werewolf fever going on right now, would you consider bringing the concept back to either movies or TV?
I can tell you that we were stopped in our efforts. I thought we talked about this last time.
Probably.
I was minding my own gosh darn business, and I got a phone call from my assistant who said, Jerry Levine is looking to talk to you. And I'm thinking to myself, Jerry Levine has to be a lawyer for somebody. Who can Jerry Levine be? And my assistant cut me off and said, Jerry Levine played Styles. And I thought, okay, great. I haven't spoken to Jerry Levine in 25 years. What could Jerry Levine possibly want? And sure enough, Jerry calls. Sounds exactly the same way. Of course, the hard is that when I finally sat down with him for lunch, he looks exactly like he does. Everyone aged but him. It's so funny. Just hilarious guy. Sweetest guy in the world. Anyway, he's been making a living as a director on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Cool.
And Everybody Hates Chris. And, you know,
oh, that's great.
Kind of great stuff. Great sense of humor. And MGM's interested in remaking the movie, and would I be interested in writing it? And I, you know, can't even finish the sentence. I'm on board. He and I figure a whole tact out as to what we want to do, which is very, very similar to the original film. We go in. We have 22 meetings with these people. You know, if you've been reading the paper, MGM is in some kind of financial straits.
Yes, they are.
And so the left hand doesn't really know what the right hand's doing. And while we were talking about making the movie, they'd sold the rights to Paramount to do a MTV television series, which I do not know anything about other than I am told that it has nothing to do with the movie, that it is much more like Twilight, but they wanted the franchise name, and I will not judge until I see.
Okay. Interesting.
But
I didn't know about that.
I have nothing to do with the show at all.
Okay. Wow, and it is crazy how, and I feel bad, I mean, the great MGM to be in the, and of course there was another time when they were in financial straits, you know, 40 years ago as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, to the point, too, where we heard this week that the plans for the next Bond have to be put on hold. Things are that bad.
Yeah, I mean, I usually when all that kind of rhetoric goes around, it means that there's an answer coming.
Sure.
And I hope that that's the case. Because all I know right now is that there's nothing planned.
And this is another question that we've gotten before, but I'll let you decide if you've answered it sufficiently or have anything new to say. The differences in writing for the DC Universe and the Marvel Universe. Michael has read Kurt Busiek talk about how the two universes have a different feel and would love to hear you opine on this.
I don't have a difference in terms of the stories that I would tell. The characters dictate what the stories are. I can tell you that, and again, I have not worked there in 5 years,
mm-hmm.
so that it could be a very different place. It was not true for me, so that I do not hold this as the truth. My experience at DC was that it was very corporate driven, and it was very much about what was in the best interest of the character as opposed to what was in the best interest of the creative team. You can't do that because they're doing this in the movie, or you can't do that because there's 111 reasons why you can't do that. And so you have to work within the confines of what that is. Whereas I have found, and again, that all may not be true anymore, so
right.
You cannot hold that out to me. It certainly can't. No one knows yet what Jeff and the gang are going to be doing. So I don't want anyone listening to this saying, well, that's how you see DC. It's not how I see DC. I'm talking about a time
Understood.
When I worked there. And it's important to say that when I look at projects that I did with Tim and that I did with Jim Lee and on Superman and Batman, I had none of those problems.
Okay.
So I just am speaking more on behalf of other people and people that I have worked with during that time. I can tell you categorically, with the exception of the time that I was in the X-Men office, and it was very early in my career, and that may have a lot to do with it as well, certainly, since Joe Quesada has been there, I have never had an experience which was not completely driven by what does the creative team want to do. If you guys want to do that, go do that. And if it works, great. And if it blows up, then we'll fix it. And it certainly makes it out to be a much more of a clubhouse feel. And, you know, that's just a fundamental difference between the way the two companies are run. I think that I'm very curious as to what Jeff's going to be doing and how he sees the next year or 20 years of comics. It's an exciting time. There's no two ways about it. I think between the changes in management over there and the changes in the delivery systems, the comics can come in. You know, whatever it is that we're talking about right now is not what we'll be talking about in 3 years or 5 years.
Right. No, I agree. And really think of where we've come in the last 10 years when, you know, Joe and...
Bill Gemmis.
Thank you, Bill Gemmis. Yes, I mean, really, exactly. Look where we were in 2000 compared to where we are now. As you say as well, not only the distribution, Disney's influence over Marvel and the possibilities of product that will come of it. And again, this new realignment of DC as well. Amazing. Amazing. And we're at the very beginning of a, you know, new decade and a new direction. And it'll be very fun to watch as it all unfolds.
So this is great fun.
Absolutely, man. Oh, this is great. Well done. And
all right.
We've reached the end.
We've reached the end. I'm sure you'll hopefully cut this down into 20-minute packs so that you can take with you on the subway.
Sounds like you're going to have a big San Diego, too.
Yeah, San Diego is certainly going to be an experience one way or the other.
Excellent. I hope to see you there.
Okay.
Great seeing you in Chicago. Thank you again.
Absolutely.
And as always, thank you for hanging out on this report. And more to come from Jeff Loeb in the pages of Ultimate X, New Ultimates, and Hulk as the story continues to unfold.
Do I get to do it? I hope I can get to it. Thanks for joining all of us here at Forbidden Planet Radio. Word Balloon can be found on your favorite network. It can be downloaded on your iPad.
That's right.
If you want to, you can put in a pack of cigarettes and smoke it.
We have the Word Balloon application now available for the iPad and the iPhone.
You do?
Indeed.
I love that.
Absolutely.
This has been a project of Word Balloon and Speaky Productions.
Well, that'll do it for this season's edition of the Loeb Report. As Marvel TV progresses and Jeff has new announcements coming in San Diego, I'm sure we'll follow up with him in the near future and go through the slate of his projects that are coming up. Don't forget, Word Balloon is also at San Diego Comic-Con, and very proud to be part of a couple really neat panels. The 5th anniversary of the Comics Podcasting panel, and I'm very proud to be there with a lot of your other favorite comic book podcasters. The podcasting panel is Thursday from 5 till 6 at room 32AB. Friday, there's a spotlight on the Imamans, Catherine and Stuart, and I'll be moderating that panel, and that happens from 12:30 to 1:30 in room 9. And then Saturday from 12:30 to 1:30 in room 6DE, Brian Bendis will be turning his spotlight panel into a live Bendis tape session. And I am very pleased to be joining Brian and moderating the panel. That's happening again Saturday from 12:30 to 1:30 in room 6DE. It's going to be a great time. Hope to see you there. If you can't make it, don't worry. You'll be hearing podcasts of all of those panels right here on Word Balloon. Today's episode was brought to you by the expert on everything, Edward David Gill's novel that's been described as Catch-22 meets 3 Days of the Condor. A young man is offered a six-figure job at Vector Systems and mistakenly handed a prototype piece of technology that can effectively wipe out all privacy in our society. He's pursued by a governor with presidential ambitions, several U.S. senators, and begins to get death threats from the technology itself, called Wallace, which seems to have developed artificial intelligence. BookReview.com gives the novel The Expert on Everything 5 stars and calls it a smooth, interesting techno thriller. Find out for yourself. You can purchase the book at Amazon.com or at Edward's website, TheExpertOnEverything.com. Check it out. It's The Expert on Everything, a novel from Edward David Gill. John Sutra saying thanks again for listening to Word Balloon. We hope you've enjoyed the coverage as we continue our Road to San Diego coverage. We're not done. More episodes coming up all the way to the week of Comic-Con. And again, you'll be hearing floor interviews, panels, and lots of other mishigas that'll be happening from San Diego. Word Balloon is happy to deliver to you all the action. Make sure you check out the Word Balloon iPhone and iPad app. It's available at iTunes, where you can find our Word Balloon archive of well over 200 interviews of comic creators, artists, writers, actors, you name it. It's all waiting for you at wordballoon.com. Questions or comments about the show, please reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. You can follow me on Twitter under my name, John Word Balloon, or through Facebook under my name, John Suntress. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.